Good afternoon and welcome to the College Financial Lady podcast. I'm Anne Garcia, a fee-only financial advisor and author of the College Financial Lady blog. Today I have Bill Nelson with me. Bill's the founder of Pacesetter Planning. He's also a financial advisor and he specializes in working with student loans. He's passionate about helping borrowers determine the most optimal way to allocate their money between paying down student loan debt and reaching other important savings goals. Like me, he's a certified financial planner, and he's also a certified student loan professional. He's based in Arlington, Virginia. Welcome, Bill.
Hi, Ann. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, it's my pleasure. I'm so glad you could join me. So let's jump in. You know, obviously, people have heard lots about student loan problem in our country, you know, over $1 trillion in outstanding student debt and whatnot. One of the questions I think that we see among a lot of, you know, high school students and their parents is how do people actually end up there? Because, you know, with direct student loans, the maximum amount an undergraduate can borrow over 4 years is $27,000. So assuming they're not making any payments, and so there's some interest accumulating, you know, that's somewhere between $27,000 and $30,000 in outstanding debt when they graduate. But we keep hearing about all these people with loan balances approaching or even into six figures. So where are those typically coming from? Are people taking out private loans? Is it grad school? You know, what's going on there?
Yeah, great question. Honestly, it's a little bit of everything that you just mentioned, right? So definitely as far as the people who I see with the biggest student loan balances almost always have some sort of grad school debt associated with them, right? You were spot on in pointing out that as part of financial aid packages, right, they limit the amount of, you know, federally insured student loans that you can take out for an undergrad degree. There really are no such limits for grad school programs. You can borrow up to the cost of attendance plus some cost of living money. And so I find that as more and more people are going back to get some sort of graduate or professional degree, that does tend to be the biggest driver I have found. Private student loans also do play a role. If you need to borrow more to attend the particular school that you are planning to attend and are unable to get that through the financial aid process, private lenders are typically willing to loan you the balance as long as there are, you know, appropriate credit or cosigner provisions in place for them, which we may talk about in a little bit. The other thing that tends to happen, I find, is that people, you know, for a variety of reasons, don't tend to aggressively repay loans in the first few years out of school. And mm-hmm. So what ends up happening is interest builds up over time. If you have unsubsidized loans, the interest will build up while you're in school. And then whenever you switch repayment plan statuses, that outstanding interest gets added to the principal balance of the loan, which doesn't, on the surface, change how much that you owe, right? If you had a $20,000 student loan balance and have $3,000 of outstanding interest, right? You know, adding those two numbers doesn't look like it really moves the needle on how much you'd owe. You were still going to owe that $23,000 in total to begin with. But when the interest is added to the principal like that, what ends up happening is that the interest compounds on the full $23,000. And so if you find yourself kind of getting into those situations and aren't being aggressive with how you're making your payments, like, the balances can just kind of grow out of control over time.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a snowball effect.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. So, yeah, I guess that, in a nutshell, there are a lot of reasons why the student loan problem is as big as it is today.
Yeah, we have we have a client we worked with a while back, and he was, you know, mid-30s, very successful in his career. But when he came out of college, he had put all his loans into 30-year repayment programs, which was great because they had, you know, $8 and $12 monthly payments. But we're like, hey, you're 35 years old and you're still paying off a relatively small amount of debt, and you will continue to do so for quite some time in the future. And he's like, yeah, that's what my 22-year-old self did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very common.
Yeah. So you mentioned students taking out private loans. Are there situations where you recommend private loans? Are there places where those are a good fit?
So the challenging thing when we talk about private loans is that they're all different, right? Well, when you apply for student loans as part of the financial aid process, all of the government issued student loans that you get through that are all the same. They all work the same way. They all have the same provisions. They're very easy to talk about with private lenders. It's a little bit like the Wild West, right? Anything goes kind of within the regulatory bounds that they are able to work in. And so it's difficult to talk through, blanket kind of statements on are private loans good or bad. In general, though, I do tend to recommend them only as a last resort, right? They really, just to kind of categorize across the industry, I have found that they tend to have fairly aggressive or fairly nasty kind of fine print clauses that just are, they're not easy to deal with at the end of the day.
Well, and we find even when there isn't fine print, there's stuff that an 18-year-old maybe doesn't understand, things like variable interest rates or income-based repayment provisions, or that payment that they're quoting is based on a 30-year payoff, whereas the payment that you're being quoted on your federal loan is a 10-year payoff. So it's not really cheaper.
Correct. Yeah. I completely agree with all of that.
Yeah. So, one of the big topics in student loans is loan forgiveness. So setting aside, campaign era talk about forgiving portions of student loans, with the actual forgiveness programs that are out there, there have been a few years now of people being eligible for loan forgiveness. And what we've seen is that very few have actually qualified. And often this is because the borrower wasn't properly enrolled in an eligible payment program or didn't follow, one of the very, very many steps involved in ensuring that their payments qualify. But so given how complicated that process is, can you explain some of the most important things for borrowers who go into income-driven plans to make sure that when they pop out the other end, they actually get the forgiveness that they're expecting?
Yeah, absolutely. And just to clarify, right, there are a few different kind of big, broad types of loan forgiveness programs that are out there. Is there any that you want to particularly kind of highlight here?
No, but, it'd be great if you could just give a quick recap on, public service loan forgiveness versus the kind of forgiveness that you get at the end of an income-driven plan.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are a few kind of more niche type forgiveness programs that are out there. There are some specifically for teachers, for example. But in general, right, the two kind of big buckets of loan forgiveness opportunities that are out there right now, one is based on employment. As you mentioned, that's the public sector loan forgiveness program. If you work for a nonprofit or the government or anything like that, you're eligible, as long as your loans are eligible, to have those loans forgiven tax-free at the end of a 10-year payment window or after you make 120 monthly payments. And then the second bucket is more long-term, and the provisions for that vary depending on the specific repayment plan that you choose. But the idea is after 20 or 25 years of making payments based on your income, then basically whatever you have left in loan balance after that time would be forgiven. Starting with that one, I guess, those kind of longer term loan forgiveness plans are a little bit dangerous because the amount that's forgiven at the end of the day is going to be treated as taxable income to you the year that the loans are forgiven. And so if you owe $100,000 and your income is $30,000, good news is that we can enroll you in an income-driven repayment plan. Your payment will be very low because it's tied to your income relative to what the loan balance is. You make those low payments for 20 or 25 years, like I said, depending on the payment plan that you choose. And at the end of that time period, whatever's left would be forgiven. Now, oftentimes, right, the payments are low enough that you're not even covering the interest that's due each month. And so in that particular example, you're likely looking at having over $100,000 in loans forgiven at the end of that time period. But right, let's even just say it is 100,000 that is forgiven. You would essentially, the government looks at it as you getting $100,000 worth of income in that year, and so, which is going to leave you with a big, big tax bill that you need to be ready to pay. And you know, if your income is low enough that sort of scenario makes sense, that's going to be hard to deal with, right? And so, generally speaking, I don't view that as a great long-term plan, right? If, you know, really for anything, you know, mm-hmm. you know, involving other financial goals, things like that. And so before you kind of set yourself up on that path, I would encourage you to think through other options and, you know, see what else you can do with them.
Yeah, because oftentimes, you know, more often than not, you, as you said, you're not even paying off the principal. So interest is accumulating month after month after month. So your $100,000 that you started with, by the time it's forgiven, could be $200,000.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a great year to take a vacation.
Yeah. Once that tax bill is due, right?
Yeah. So at least you don't have any other income coming before that to add to that year's tax bill.
Right.
And then public service loan forgiveness is different.
Yes, correct. And I think that was the one it sounded like you were alluding to, talking through, you know, the number of people who have been rejected from forgiveness who have applied over the past few years. So that, you know, just the, I guess to take a step back, public service loan forgiveness, you are eligible for forgiveness if you have the right types of federal loans. You're on a qualifying repayment plan, and you make 120 monthly payments while holding a job at a 501c3 nonprofit or for the government. In a nutshell, that's how that works. The nice thing about that program is that you're not subject to the taxable loan balance that we were just talking about with the other form of loan forgiveness. The challenges that you alluded to about people who are applying and are not, you know, and haven't been able to get approved for it, are really more applicable to people who took out loans, you know, in the mid to late 2000s. The challenge with that program is that, you know, for a variety of reasons, the Department of Education changed the way that they were issuing federal student loans in July of 2010. And as it just so happened that prior to July of 2010, 90% or so of the loans that were given as part of financial aid packages never qualified for public service loan forgiveness to begin with. And so, you know, I started doing student loan planning back in 2016. They hadn't even released the first application for public service loan forgiveness, but, you know, when I first got started, because it was a program that was created in 2007 in the first round of applicants on a 10-year, you know, forgiveness request for, you know, came through in 2017. You know, I've been saying for years that you would not see a lot of people actually get public service loan forgiveness until like starting sometime like later this year, because most of the loans that were issued prior to July of 2010 never qualified to begin with. And you know, that is something that has been corrected. You're going to start to see the numbers on that program turn around a little bit more.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's, you know, one of the things that is so unfortunate about these repayment provisions is, on the one hand, they are tremendously beneficial to borrowers, especially early in their careers, but the rules are so arcane and vary based on, you know, what year you took out what loan and,
mm-hmm. Yes.
And there isn't good guidance coming from the loan servicers about how you even get into these programs or what steps you need to be doing on an annual basis to, you know, to continue to qualify.
Yeah, absolutely. That hopefully will be changing. The Department of Education is changing the loan servicers out, starting, I believe, later this year. And so my hope is that the new folks who come in will have a little bit more training to help guide borrowers through that. The other challenge that I think is worth talking about with public service loan forgiveness are potential future changes to the program. And you know, I talk to a lot of people who are concerned that, you know, about taking out a couple $100,000 a year for, you know, some sort of grad program to work at a nonprofit. only to have that program be taken away at some point in the future. And, you know, what I typically tell folks is for people who have already taken out loans, like who are already either in school or already in repayment, the odds of a change coming to the program in a meaningful way in the next decade or so is relatively low. For people who are already in school, have already started to take out loans, I really wouldn't worry about that all that much. Both because, you know, a lot of these provisions were baked into the promissory notes that you signed when you took the loans out. That there's a longstanding precedent in student loan policy to apply changes only to future borrowers rather than worry about people with, you know, changing things on people with existing student loans. I don't think that's much of a risk. Yeah. But for people who are in high school right now, or parents of folks who are in high school right now, I do think there is a likelihood that this program will change that will affect future borrowers. And so, you know, yes, it's out there right now. Yes, it could potentially be there for decades to come. But both the Trump administration and the Obama administration talked about kind of making pretty significant changes to the way that this program operates. It never actually went through. But I think that the odds of there being a change that does affect future borrowers in the next decade is relatively high. And so that's just the other note I would add.
Well, and that raises an interesting point, right? Because, you know, when we talked about this being a lot of, a lot of graduate students, you know, graduate school can last, you know, 4-6 years, mm-hmm. maybe longer for the perpetual student, and mm-hmm. you're taking out a new set of loans every year. So in theory, you could have students who are, you know, starting a graduate program now on the expectation that there'll be loan forgiveness, but that may only apply to some portion of their loan balance. And I guess we could spend a whole bunch of time speculating about that or not.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, completely agree.
You alluded to the fact that there's a lot of different income-driven or income-based repayment plans. Can you give the 30,000-foot view of kind of what the key pieces are?
Yeah, absolutely. And this is where, you know, what student loans you have when you borrow them, like that all comes into play, right? For people who are taking out student loans nowadays, it actually is a pretty straightforward calculation. There are five income-driven payment plans that are out there. There's really only three that would ever make sense for students who are taking out loans. And, you know, for people who are entering college in the next few years, it really is actually only two that would be the optimal choices. And so I don't know how much detail you want me to go into on that. The plans in question are the pay-as-you-earn plan, or PAYE, mm-hmm. and the revised pay-as-you-earn plan, REPAYE. Those are the two plans for folks who, you know, have started taking out student loans over the past 5 years and going forward. Those are the two plans I would steer people toward.
Okay, great. Can you tell me a little bit about the, you know, the similarities and differences between those two?
Yeah, absolutely. Good question. So both of those plans, there's a few subtleties, but the big kind of, I guess, the overall look at them, they each tie the kind of annual amount you're paying on the student loans to 10% of what the government determines your discretionary income to be, which essentially they look at how much money you're making minus anything you're putting into 401k or any other income deductions you can take like that. And then they subtract out a factor that's based on the poverty level, based on your family size and where you live. And they take 10% of that. And that is how much you pay on an annual basis. That calculation is the same for each of those plans. And so, you know, if you're just comparing, you know, that, you know, the two plans against each other, the payment amount appears to be the same at first glance. The differences under the pay-as-you-earn plan, you're allowed to, you know, if you are married and your spouse has their own separate income, you're allowed to separate out your income from your spouse's. And so under the pay-as-you-earn plan, If you have a relatively low income and your spouse has a relatively high income, it can be very advantageous to you to to separate out your income on your taxes and base your student loan payment on the relatively low income that you have.
So then that requires you to file married filing separate.
It does. Yeah. And there are a lot of reasons why that might not make sense for you to do. But particularly if you're pursuing one of the forgiveness programs that we just discussed, that can be a pretty attractive opportunity for you.
Okay. So pay as you earn, you can file married filing separate and have your payments based solely on your own income. So that would imply that repay
yes.
does not allow you to do that.
That is correct. Yes. Revised pay as you earn, you need to look at both you and your spouse's income together. Obviously for most people coming out of college, like they're not married right away. So that is something that you won't necessarily, like they won't present you with as a potential problem, but it is something you want to keep in mind. The benefit of revised pay as you earn, though, that the other ones don't have, is that half of, if your payment is low enough that you're not even covering the interest that's due on the loans each month, which is fairly common in when you're on one of these plans, half of the interest that you don't pay is essentially just forgiven on the spot each month. And so you build up less interest over time, which can be really good if you're, for example, just starting a business or something like that, and your income is relatively low for a few years. You can end up paying less over time by being on that plan just because they forgive half of the interest that's due that is unpaid each month.
Okay. And that's just for the first 3 years or?
That is for the first 3 years for unsubsidized loans, and it's ongoing for subsidized loans, I believe.
Okay. Yeah. So that can definitely be a really nice benefit. So getting back to sort of, we have the student borrowers with the very large balances, and then we have the sort of the everyone else student borrowers, the students who take out the direct student loan every year and they graduate, with the $27,000 to $30,000, in total outstanding student loans. Typically that translates, if they want to do the 10-year payment plan, that translates to about $350 a month, which is, a reasonable investment in a college education. But, we've seen a lot of instances where either people take a lot longer than that to pay off those loans and end up spending considerably more, or they do it a lot quicker. So what are some of the things that you might suggest to someone who wants to pay off their loans more quickly?
Yeah, sure. Good question. So yeah, to your point, right, there really are kind of two optimal strategies for student loans, right? You either try to lower the monthly payment as much as you possibly can. And there are reasons that you might want to do that. We've talked about a lot of them up until this point. And then there's getting rid of the loans as quickly and aggressively as you can. And so for people who are in that camp, what I would tell you, I have found with the people I work with over time, is that the people who pick one thing to focus on at a time tend to make progress the fastest. And so what I would do is, determine kind of what it is, where it is you want your money to take you over the next 10 to 15 years, whether that's buying a home or, traveling or whatever the case is, right? And kind of determine where, paying off the loans fits into that sort of framework. And I would consider also not just the interest that you're paying as the cost of having the loans around, but I would also consider the flexibility that not having that monthly payment in your life would do for you. I've seen people who have gone to start businesses, right, that wouldn't have been able to necessarily if they had these big student loan payments still in their life. And so, what I would tell those folks to do is, pick one thing, whether it's the loans or other types of debt or, saving for a down payment on a home, and focus as much of your energy as possible on taking care of that before you move on to the next thing.
I think that's a great suggestion. So consolidating loans or not consolidating loans, you know, for someone who's in the standard, you know, your standard undergraduate set of loans, that $27,000, give or take, balance. And do you generally recommend, you know, or what are your thoughts about consolidating the loan balance?
Yeah.
I know for a lot of people, they go, oh, I could have one payment instead of eight.
Right. Yeah. And so the first thing I tend to talk about with people who ask me that question is just to make sure that we're talking about the same thing. Because I find that people use the word consolidate student loans and refinance student loans interchangeably. And they're very different, as you're aware. So the consolidating federal student loans is a federal government, Department of Education program, where, as you alluded to, right, if you take out one loan for every semester of undergrad in a 4-year program, you have 8 student loans. You're making 8 monthly payments. Through consolidating it through the federal government, you're given one loan back, and so it's nice and easy. You make one monthly payment. There are a couple of really good reasons to do that for people who took out loans like several years ago, who can, by consolidating, you can get access to some of the newer features, because as I alluded to earlier, when they make changes to student loan policy, it tends to only be for future borrowers or for new loans. And so that really is the only time I recommend people go through the consolidation process, as if doing so would make your loans eligible for some of these other forgiveness programs or things like that that we're talking through. The problem with there's really two problems with consolidating, just to get one monthly payment. The first is that you lose the ability when you do that to target paying down your loans by interest rates. Typically, for people who have multiple student loans, they'll be issued at different interest rates. And, you might want to pay down the one with the lowest balance first, or the one with the highest interest rate first. And when you consolidate, you lose the ability to do that. And you actually end up paying a little bit more in interest, because they take the weighted average of all the loans to calculate the new interest rate on the consolidation loan, but they actually round it up to the nearest 1/8%. And so there's actually a negative interest rate impact, albeit a relatively minor one, to consolidating. And so, in general, I typically don't recommend that.
It's a high price to pay for a small convenience.
Yeah. Yeah. The more fun way to only have one student loan payment is to pay off the rest.
It's to pay off the rest of
them. That's right.
Yeah. Plus, you get that feeling of success when you get one paid off.
Yeah, absolutely. The only other thing that might be worth mentioning is, we haven't talked about parents who are taking out student loans at all, right? But the parent plus loans that also can be issued through financial aid packages, those are not directly eligible for any of the income driven payment plans. And so if you're a parent who's taken out parent plus loans and want to get on a plan like that, you would need to consolidate them in order to do that.
Yeah. Okay. So that's one reason why you would consolidate, is if you've taken out parent plus loans and you want an income driven
yes
repayment,
yep, absolutely,
option. Yeah. So you've been doing this for a while and you've worked with a lot of borrowers. Any what's your worst case scenario that if you could try to steer anyone away from, and you have a couple minutes to describe it before we, before we wrap up, what would you want high school students who are thinking about borrowing for college, or their parents who are thinking about borrowing for college, to know and avoid?
Yeah. Great question. I think the most important thing when you're dealing with student loans is to be intentional with them. Right. It's very easy to sign the piece of paper when you're 18 years old, go off to college, not think about it for 4 years, and then all of a sudden, find yourself making these payments. You're not sure what to do with them. They give you the chance to keep the payments low. You decide to do that, and then 10 years go by and you owe more than you had originally borrowed, because your payments have been low enough that just the interest is built up over time. And so I would say, like I said, right, there are two kind of good strategies to choose from, depending on your circumstance. keep the payments as low as possible, or basically make the payments as high as possible to get rid of them faster. And so, you know, either one of those paths can make sense depending on what it is you're trying to do with your career and your other financial goals. But I think it's really important to have a game plan for exactly how they're going to get repaid and or forgiven over time.
Yeah. And I think, you know, we see so many times, you know, people who are in, you know, for example, law school or, you know, one of those graduate programs where it's very, very expensive and they're already borrowing a ton of money and they're like, oh, I'll just, mm-hmm. you know, I'll just volunteer for the summer because it really doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. I borrowed so much at this point, what's another $10,000? And that can lead to some very unfortunate consequences.
Absolutely.
Well, Bill, this has been incredibly helpful and enlightening. Before we sign off, any final words of wisdom?
No, I don't think so. You know, thanks so much for having me. And like I said, you know, I think just, you know, being intentional with how you are approaching taking out the loans and repaying them is about all the wisdom I have. So.
Well, and I think that's a great framework for looking at this. Where can people find out more about your services?
Yeah, great question. So I am, my firm is Paysetter Planning. You can go to paysetterplanning.com. I have a pretty extensive student loan guide there that needs a little bit of a facelift that I'm working on right now. But that's probably the best place to find me.
Excellent. Well, Bill, thank you so much.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you.